sessions sponsored by the Canadian Social Economy Hub. We ask at this time for all the participants to mute your phone line, and you can do that by pressing *6, and that it allows you to mute and unmute. However, for the first part of the session, if you could mute your line, and then we'll unmute during the question and answer period after the two speakers have spoken. Just so that you know, any kind of background noise will be heard very loudly, and if you do need to leave the call, please hang up and dial in again. Just from experience in the past, if you put your phone on hold, there'll be some nice music in the background for everyone to hear, and we don't want that to happen. So the Canadian Social Economy Hub is a national social economy research program that is co-led by the University of Victoria and the Canadian CED Network. It involves practitioner organizations and universities from across Canada with a national hub and regional centers in different parts of the country. And through funding from federal government, Social Science and Humanities Research Council, research is being undertaken to understand how the approaches of the social economy can be better understood and effectively applied so that community organizations, civil society, community developers and researchers can collaborate to empower groups and communities to meet their social and economic needs. So this morning, we're looking at building more sustainable food and agriculture systems and looking at the role of the social economy within that. And during this session, speakers will address the following questions. How will building better sustainable food and agriculture systems help with climate change, nutrition, and health imperatives? What are the key ingredients to building sustainable food and agriculture systems? And how is the social economy and community economic development a factor in this? So my name is Rochelle McElroy, and I am the Knowledge Mobilization Specialist with the Canadian CED Network, and I'll be moderating today's session. And in your dial-in information, you received information about today's chat room. So if you haven't done so already, we'll be running a chat room concurrently with today's telelearning session. And it really gives a chance for participants to interact in another way, and you can post resources and ask questions. To get access to, if you have access to a computer, please dial in now, and that is http://www.chatzy.com/CSEHub. So at any time during the session, please feel free to use the chat line to direct questions and comments. If you're not in front of a computer, you will have an opportunity to ask questions after both speakers have finished, and we really look forward to your participation. So let's begin with our first speaker. We're very pleased to have Alec Ostry here this morning, and he's Canada's research chair in the Social Determinants of Community Health and is also a senior scholar with the Michael Smith Foundation for Health Research in British Columbia. So please go ahead, Alec. Look forward to your presentation.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Great to be here this morning. What I want to do, the social economy is obviously very important in terms of promoting food security in relation to climate change and other issues as well. But what I want to do is sort of bring to bear five reasons why local food security is going to matter even more in the very near future. Because I think we need to understand the local food and social economy in relationship to some of the broad global changes that are underway. And I think it's also a motivating factor that may help motivating policymakers. So I want to look at these five reasons. And, you know, a lot of you probably don't read the Financial Times. I do because, and I also read the Wall Street Journal a lot, not because I'm a right-wing fascist, but because I'm really interested in how the corporate world is dealing with food security because it has implications for the local food economy. I want to bring to your attention a Financial Times article of October 12th. The headline says, "Dramatic supply squeeze threatens to bring repeat of global food crisis." And by repeat of global food crisis, they're talking about the food crisis of 2007 when prices of many staples went through the roof, generating food riots in various local places. One of the headlines, after the headline on October 12th, I want to quote from this article, "Fears of a global food crisis swept the world's commodity markets as prices for staples such as corn, rice, and wheat spiraled after the government warned of dramatically lower supplies." So again, this headline occurs because of a government report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Furthermore, according to the Financial Times, the fall in supplies has prompted countries such as Russia and Ukraine to impose export restrictions on grains. Big importers in the Middle East and North Africa have started to hoard supplies. Note that as food supplies decline, major exporters cut back exports or ban them entirely. People in major import nations begin to hoard staple foods. The lesson here is that in a globalized world, a steady supply of well-priced food is key to food security. We have to think about whether or not these long global food chains, in the context of financial instability and climate change, are going to be the key to food security that industry keeps on telling us they are. The other thing we have to understand is that global demand for food is increasing. And again, in a related Financial Times article on the same issue, the headline is, "Downbeat Corn Report Stirs Up a Buying Frenzy." Economists at the Food and Agriculture Organization state that anything other than a record crop, you need to really listen to that, anything other than a record crop is now a problem because of the need to meet rising food, livestock, and ethanol fuel demand. In other words, we need a record crop every year now, or we're up shit creek without a paddle. Because of the high levels of demand. And in terms of corn, this is partly because of the ethanol issue. The Financial Times article goes on to say, while reduced supply is an issue, the bigger factor remains the strength of demand. In particular, corn has experienced a structural shift in demand. Ethanol now consumes one-third of U.S. corn, and the U.S. is responsible for 40% of corn production in the world. And corn is now a major feed for livestock in China, India, and the rest of Asia. And why is this going on? Because of the growing demand for Western diets in formerly third-world nations. The thing we have to understand is how fast this demand is developing. If you read today's Globe and Mail, you'll see that one of the front page articles in the business section is about what's happening to the nut market, particularly the pecan market, which the amount of pecans that they were produced, mainly in the States and Mexico, that's the main producer, used to match supply. Suddenly, with China's demand, the prices of these products are going right through the roof. And this is the future for food. Demand here. Another example in relation to China. 2008 and 9 imported 50,000 tons of corn. This year, China will import over 1 million tons of corn. The speed of increase in demands now is accelerating way beyond what we're used to. So we're going to see some very new things. So we're moving really to a perfect storm of increased demand and increased supply as limits on arable land are reached. And this is before we even begin to discuss the impacts of climate change. These are just the demands coming as millions of people are converted from the poor to the middle classes. Given that arable land is now fully planted, more or less, the pressures for increasing production will intensify pressures to move towards more genetic and industrial farming methods. The increased intensity of industrial agriculture in a world facing climate change will run very quickly into severe constraints. Greater emphasis on intense agriculture necessarily means more greenhouse gas emissions per acre, which will speed up the negative impacts of climate change. The point here is that with all these pressures building, we can't intensify our way out of this problem, specifically because climate change is coming down the pipe, too. We've got to figure out ways to produce more without intensifying greenhouse gas emissions and shifting people to different sorts of diets that reduce GHG emissions. Climate change is now going to decrease food supply. I'm just writing the white paper for the Pacific Institute of Climate Change on future impact of climate change on BC's food security. The issues for vegetable and fruit food security are fascinating in BC because we've reduced in the last 25 years our production of vegetables and fruits. Nutritionists are telling us we need to eat more. Where do we get most of our vegetables and fruits from today? From California. What's happening in California? Huge droughts and even more climate change disasters predicted. Anyway, back to the Financial Times. Climate change will also decrease food supply. An example is Russia. Especially hot summer in the U.S., in Russia, killed grain crops there and led to our KGB, ex-KGB head of Russia, Vladimir Putin, to basically cut exports off from Russia, again, spiking the price of grain. All these issues point to the need to move towards more local control of food supply chains. So as climate change evolves, this is a huge, huge issue for BC. The other thing here that we have to be cognizant of is that that the pressure, if you like, of nutrition-related, diet-related illness in British Columbia and other places, we need to move the population to eating more local food produced in a sustainable manner in order to improve also the health of the population. Anyway, those are the five main things I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk mainly, as I said, about the global impacts that are coming down the pipe and the motivator, if you like, to push towards more control over local food security. I think that's my time, I would suspect. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Alec. Very interesting. Never even considered how just increase in demand is impacting our food security. And then combined with that, climate change. So very interesting perspective. So our second speaker is Linda Geggy, and she is the coordinator of the Capital Region Food and Agriculture Initiative Roundtable and is a community food lead for the capacity building project at the Office of Community-Based Research at the University of Victoria, and is also a network developer for the BCHLA Capacity Building Project with the Vancouver Island Food Systems Network. Thank you, Linda, for joining us this morning.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
Over to you.
Thank you. Well, I think I'm going to echo what Alec said in terms of what I'd like to put out for you this morning, and that is his call to looking at local supply in our food chains, because this seems to me as, in terms of, when I talk to my community-based and academic colleagues, this is where people seem to be anchoring where we need to go. So I did, 20 years ago, when I first got involved with work around food and sustainability, I was part of a youth group that later evolved into the Life Cycles organization, and the focus of our work was on supporting community gardens, and it was a strategic choice of the organization because we felt that community gardens were an excellent community organizing tool. They provided citizens with the opportunity to increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables. They put people's hands in the dirt to reconnect with natural cycles. Improved, you know, opportunities for exercise and socialization with neighbors. And in some cases, gardeners traded and sold their goods as well. It also had the added benefits of providing pockets and connectors for biodiversity and the provision of ecological services to cities. And I'm pointing to this because to this day I still believe that community gardens are simple and powerful examples of how people come together around food, and it has far-reaching and multiple benefits. And the example of community gardens in many ways exemplifies the way that involvement in food system-based initiatives cuts across some of these most pressing issues that you're pointing to in your questions. It's important to, and this is what food system initiatives do, is understand our connection and interdependence with natural systems and our impacts on the climate. It's about our relationship with food and health and the well-being of individuals and communities. And it's also, the food system initiatives that I'm seeing are engaging a collective imagination and effort in terms of looking at how can we retool our food systems and rebuild more localized economies. About 10 years ago, I was involved in a survey that looked across Canada at these types of food security initiatives that I'm talking about in terms of community gardens, but also community economic development and social enterprise initiatives like fruit tree projects, community kitchens, community-supported agriculture. And there was a real germination of these types of activities going on across Canada. And now we've seen an exponential rise in these projects and also the organizations and work that is involved in supporting them. And this includes, as you know, I'm in, and as you introduced, Rochelle, in my work in network building, and as many of you are that are on the call are also involved in these initiatives, I think we have to really look at the importance of how we are connecting all of these small and important initiatives on the ground to a larger movement of relocalization of the food system. And I work with the Capital Region Food and Agriculture Initiatives Roundtable. It's a regional food and farm networking, information sharing, capacity building kind of entity. We are part of the BC Food Systems Network, and this BC Food Systems Network has been working around British Columbia to build capacity in rural and urban areas across food system initiatives. And one of the key things that the network has identified is building sub-regional networks as a real important strategy to build our capacity across the province. Not only is this kind of organizing happening kind of within BC and within the regions, but also the BCFSN is linked to Food Secure Canada and the Community Food Security Network in the States, and connected again globally to groups like Via Campesina. It's an international farmer-led movement. So the reason I'm talking about this networking is because I think the networks are really important in terms of showing a movement of people working on creating a cultural shift around our relationship with food and how we get food to our plate, and that they are also promoting and building capacity for food system initiatives. And perhaps, I don't want to say most importantly, but critically, generating collaboration around creating necessary policy change. So the kinds of initiatives that we're seeing as policy change around food safety and consumer rights, around the importance in health promotion nutrition and working, the nutritionists have been a real beacon for me in our network in terms of their advocacy around the importance of food security and the importance that our food production systems also need to be oriented toward health, not just towards growing commodities that are for sale for export. So you asked us to talk about what we thought the key ingredients were to building sustainable food and agriculture systems. And I have to put it first off that I'm firmly in belief that relocalization of the food system is the key ingredient to greater sustainability. And I think that echoes what Alex is saying within this global context. I'm not in denial that trade will still continue. It has for thousands of years. However, global trade systems as our primary delivery model of our food system is greatly flawed for all of these important reasons that the questions have centered on. And I think that we really need to get away from the myth of efficiency, and as Alex said, this idea that intensification of production is the answer. Really, there is study after study that shows that small-scale sustainable agriculture fits the requirements that we have for global food supply, and that not only are they better production methods in terms of environmental systems, but also more productive, higher yield, better quality food. And I think that's kind of, we need to ensure a number of things in our proposals for rebuilding these localized food systems. And I think that we're seeing this across the food movement, people taking the food systems approach. So that means starting with looking at the diversity and resilience in seeds and fertility of soils, considering production, processing, distribution, wholesale, retail, food preparation, consumption, and then ends again with looking at food waste as a resource that closes the loop by returning to soil and nurturing fertility. We need to be incorporating true cost accounting. That's including all the financial, environmental, and social costs associated with food when we're making policy decisions. Really seeing this around healthcare costs related to food as one that we're starting to think about how we can look at policy and relationship to our food production. And I think we're really quite far away from that still. Like our current Ministry of Agriculture policy is really oriented not towards feeding people, but towards food production. And as Alex said, he's done a great study looking at food production in the last 25 years, that our production is going more towards meats and dairy, and it's any vegetables and fruits are more oriented towards export to our greenhousing in British Columbia. So this is in direct contradiction to what nutritionists are telling us. We need to eat more grains and fruits and vegetables, and that should be the touchstone for our agriculture policy and programs. Of course, other key ingredients is that food needs to be accessible to everyone, and that really touches on social policy. We need to ensure that with living wage and affordable housing, those things are not, they're interconnected, inextricable from one another. We know that household food security is directly related to cost of housing, especially in where I live in this region, huge housing affordability issues, and that takes money out of your food budget. So other key pieces that I wanted to touch on were obviously the economic viability of farming and food production for the small-scale producer, and that's about a whole retool of the food distribution and marketing system. Again, comes back to true costs of food and those externalities that are being subsidized and other levels. It also comes down to consumer awareness about what it takes to grow food and what food is worth, and that we can't compare products. And we've been doing it for the last 50 years, comparing two different pieces of food that are have such different costs, but the price that you're paying at your till is not reflective of those things. So the last point that I want to talk about in terms of the key ingredients is that food really needs to nourish. And we need to be looking at the food that's produced and primarily consumed right now is high fat, high sugar, high salt, and highly processed. So getting back to diets that are more seasonally based, whole foods, not living under a disillusionment that we live in a very busy life with most people having both of people working in the household, both parents working in the household, and so convenience is a real issue. And so how do we rebuild our culture and our lifestyles around being able to eat the foods that nourish us? I'm just going to touch on that last question that you asked, how is the social economy and community economic development a factor? Well, it's my belief and has been my belief that these are driving factors actually in retooling and rebuilding food systems. Bringing people together through social enterprises is some of the most innovative and solution-based approaches that I've seen. And I want to kind of give you three really good examples from our region that I think are interesting. One is the Food Roots Distributors Co-op, and it's a co-op that is being in operation for quite five to ten years. I always lose track of time. Always feels like it was 5 years ago, and people tell me it was 10. So, but what they have done is provided a forum for local growers to sell together and distribute through local pocket markets, and also bulk buying directed to consumers. And what this has allowed for is to build the capacity of the small-scale growers in a very flexible marketing tool for them. And so they've been able to provide enough and diversity of foods at a market table and to set up pocket markets where consumers can come and there's a direct connection to the farmers through the people working at the pocket markets, as well as the ability to source at the neighborhood level local foods. So it's a really great model. It still has lots of challenges in terms of being able to integrate with our culture and how we buy and access food. But it's a really great model that I'd like to see proliferate. The other one I want to talk about is Heritage Foods Co-op. And I know, Ken Babich, you're on the call from the, is a purchaser from the University of Victoria, and Heritage Foods Co-op has been working to try and access selling to institutions. And I know some people are familiar with the Local Foods Plus work of Lori Stahlbrand, and this is along the similar lines. What Heritage Foods Co-op is trying to do is bring local farmers together to share infrastructure to process their goods, and this includes leasing and abattoirs and as so that they can also increase meat production on the island and distribution on the island. And so the Heritage Foods Co-op, you can just Google them. They've got, I think the work that they're doing is really amazing. As well, there's just one other example I want to talk about, and that's in terms of food access and recovery, which is there's a working group that CR Fair is supporting, and they're trying to develop a tool to collectively share resources around recovered and donated food. So not only a way to deal with, you know, unloading, for example, 15 turkeys on the women's transition house when they can't, they don't want to say no, but they can only actually deal with one or two turkeys. How can they share that food with the other 39 agencies in Victoria that are dealing with hunger? But also how they can share transportation and storage and their volunteer base. And so we're developing a virtual tool to be able to facilitate the sharing and recycling of food. And part of that, and a future part of that, is looking at particularly local food sources, and that's the next step and layer to this, to that project. So those were just three really good examples of that are looking at trying to support increasing food production and distribution recovery as well. So I think I'll end it there. I'm over my time, but I'll thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Linda. Yeah, you touched on some really important points. I just want to recap, especially the synergistic satisfying ability of community gardens and how they satisfy so many of our human needs of, you know, human interaction and learning and self-expression and just connection with the earth. So, and also the economic benefits of community gardens as well. And I really like how you brought in the social economy in that, and how it's really a driving factor, you noted, in, you know, bringing people together and retooling. You gave some great examples of, you know, food routes distribution co-op and the pocket markets that just pop up all over the place here in Victoria, and some other great examples. So thanks so much for bringing that local perspective. And so now we're going to move on to the question and answer period, so I'm just going to mute.
The conference is no longer in lecture mode.
So I've just unmuted all the participants. So now for the last half hour of the session, you have a chance to ask Linda and Alec any questions that you might have from their presentations or areas of interest. So I'm just going to open up the floor right now and go ahead and also post questions on the chat line. So any questions? Okay, we have a bit of a silent group. Maybe people have muted their line, so to unmute, you can *6. Just putting that out there. So if there are any questions, I'd like to ask one myself. I guess for Alec, I was wondering, what's your favorite example you know, on a global level of an organization addressing food security in maybe a new innovative way that we haven't seen in Canada?
I don't know offhand. I'm probably not the best person to ask about global organizations that are doing that. Linda maybe knows more than I do about that.
Well, there's so many good examples, and they're so diverse in their approaches. I think that's one of the things that's a real richness around the work being done around food. I think some of the things that are really interesting, though, is the connecting. And I would point to Via Campesina as a very vocal organization that is working. You know, it's very grassroots in terms of and radical, largely indigenous farmer base as well, which is really important. And working very hard on global and national food policy, which really affects people's ability to own land, to do business. So if people haven't checked out Via Campaign in the past, I would look at that.
Hi, this is Herb. I'd suggest, in keeping with Linda's, thank you both for the excellent presentations, in keeping with Linda's talk about networks, Sustain UK is one of the oldest and one of the largest Alliance for Better Food and Farming, and they've done a superb job of networking hundreds of organizations in the UK.
Great. Any other questions? And please let me know where you're calling from, too. It'd be great to hear that.
Shirley Thompson. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yvonne here in Quebec City. I suggest that it's for CSA, Agriculture, there's an international network called Urgency. U-R-G-E-N-C-Y. So they have they had the last conferences in Japan, and they in France, and they are involved in some southern countries. There are a few examples, but it's more, and if you want to know the history of this movement, there's on the website, there's an article written by an American called Anderson, I think it's Hazel, I'm not sure, or Helen, and there's a history of this CSA movement, which is quite interesting.
Fantastic.
Can I add a comment?
And please go ahead and post that resource on the chat line, too.
Yeah, I will. I'll do that.
Okay.
My comment would be another thing on globally is the fact that if you probably seen last week or 2 weeks ago that at the UN they had the MDG meeting for the Millennium Development Goals, and civil society organizations around the world are saying that if you want to struggle and get rid of poverty, you have to help small farmers, because 70% of the billion people in the world who are under very poor, 70% live in rural regions. So this is clearly in Africa, for example. I was in a meeting a couple of years ago. Clearly, they want to help the small farmers to survive, and so this is really a key point. It's the local, as you were mentioning in the call, but it's more than that. It's to help people get out of poverty, because right now the global food system is doing its best to make profit for big multinational corporations. But third point would be organic farming. There's a real problem there. Organic farming by itself is good, but for example, in Japan, 85% of organic that is consumed in Japan is imported. In Quebec province here, it's about 75%, which is imported. So that's import from U.S. mostly. So there's a huge problem there, because we also have to think about food mileage. So that's something we'll have to address well, and make sure that also we have government policies here to support organic, but organic for not for multinational corporations like in some parts of the U.S. It's small farmers. They can be able to survive, because otherwise the food system here in Canada and most Western countries is controlled by five or six huge big players like Loblaws and others. And they are getting rid of the small farmers, because small farmers can't sell to them. So local markets, CSA or other things like that are practically the only solution here, but also in other countries of the world, because otherwise, in Japan, for example, a lot of the farming land is not used anymore, because it's a very small lots of land, a few hectares here and there, and the only survival mode will be local farming for local markets. Otherwise, you can't compete within the system. So I wanted to add that point.
Thank you, Yvonne. And there was another question from Shirley, I believe.
Yes, Shirley Thompson from Manitoba, University of Manitoba.
Great.
I'm research First Nations communities in northern Manitoba, but also other Indigenous people in Canada, and look at food security issues there. And I'm just wondering, policy constraints of Health Canada for using country foods and institutions, or even in any public places. What would you remote locations where there's really, with the tendency of federal processing facilities only being in the South, how can these communities survive, and what are the policy solutions?
I think that's a great question. It's Alec here. I can try and answer it. In British Columbia, you're kind of talking about what the unintended, we think, consequences of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency's regulations around meat, which have essentially driven out a lot of farm gate processors and small abattoirs, right? So if you're living in a small remote community, a native community, your ability to process meat without being harassed by health inspectors is limited. In fact, you're driven underground. So in BC, what's going on, it's quite interesting, is they've developed a new innovative plan to get around this by developing new licenses and training facilities. And this is being rolled out right now. So there may be, and we think it's fairly unique, and we think that it may be that other jurisdictions, such as Manitoba, and particularly remote communities in Manitoba, could use this. Does that help?
Yes, and are you going to provide a link or anything? I know there's very little available on the web. There's a mention of BC and their Head Start program using these small facilities, but I'm not sure if it would apply, but there's got to be some hope.
Well, so there is.
Great.
Yeah, there is a model underway. It's early days here in BC, but we're involved in evaluating it as it rolls out. And, you know, I would say look in about 6 months for results from this thing. Right now it's sort of under wraps, but it should be, more information should be available on this in about 6 months.
And where would we look?
BC Ministry of Health, Food Safety, that kind of thing.
Okay, thank you.
That kind of place, yeah. Or you can contact me in 6 months.
Okay.
I have a quick question on this issue for Alec. This is Beth, and do those licenses and sort of special little things that they're setting up apply for wild game as well, or is it just for farm-raised?
So far, I believe it's just for farm-raised, but this issue does come up, and it will come up increasingly.
That was the question I heard from... Sorry, I don't remember. The woman from Manitoba.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Was how do Indigenous people get wild meat into their Head Start programs, into their school lunch programs?
Yeah.
You know?
I have a question.
Right. Yes, please go ahead. Where are you calling from?
My name is Annette Andwada. I work with Alberta Agriculture in Edmonton, and we are doing an analysis to see how we can support local food from a policy level. And I'm wondering if there's been any kind of systematic work done that has looked at what policies need to change either on a national or provincial or even municipal level that would foster food systems. Is anyone aware of any work that's already been done that's kind of looked at that? I know it's a huge question, but if anybody knows of any things that would be help us to have a bit of a head start on that.
It's Alec here. I think that that's a hugely important question. I think that local food security advocates have to look at that question, and that we have to begin to do more research in that area. In other words, we need to look at how current national and provincial agricultural policies hinder local food security developments and what policies need to be put in place. We need to look at things, for example, like marketing boards. What's the role of marketing boards in either preventing local food security initiatives moving forward or helping them? So, for example, if you look at British Columbia, the most local food in British Columbia is milk.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we've got huge local production of milk, dairy products, very little import of milk, very little export of milk. And this is the single, I would argue, most local industry in British Columbia. And it's largely industrial and out of the hands of a lot of small farmers. But, you know, if you look at a global scale, this is our most local industry. You know, how do we, and does the market arrangements we've got in place for milk have to do with making it local? You know, what, and I think what we need to do is really look at questions of market, to figure these things out.
And do you know if anything has been done that's kind of...
No, I don't.
Written that, okay.
No.
Herb Barbalat in Vancouver. There's more than a decade's work on
on the question you asked about policy recommendations, food assessments for health authorities and for various government bodies. The Vancouver Food Policy 80-page paper just out.
Can you say that again? You got cut off.
Sorry. Vancouver Food Policy Council is just publishing a 180-page paper with a lot of policy recommendations. The City of Vancouver social planning, I'll write it out, but the Vancouver Food Policy Council has a website with a large number of documents on it and reference various studies.
Thank you.
But Herb, this is Alec here. My sense of those documents are that they're regional and locally focused, and I thought the question was really about national policies that look at local issues.
Yeah, it has some of both. You're right that most of it is local.
Right.
Just one other comment on your comment about the milk, Alec.
Yeah.
The actual supply of the milk comes from hundreds of small dairy operations,
yes,
and that have been working as co-ops or less so in recent days, but they feed into the larger system, so local farmers do supply the system.
Right. I think the point I'm trying to make with that, I agree with you 100%, Herb. The point I'm trying to make is it's that it's something about the marketing setup for milk that makes it that enables it to have been local. In other words, the market is set up in such a way to protect locals from imports. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that we need to shift from discussions about land a lot to discussions about markets and put some research efforts in that direction.
Janice Sanford-Beck here in Saskatoon.
Question
about the pocket markets. At CHEP, we're concerned with supporting local producers, and also about improving access to healthy foods for low-income people. And so sometimes those goals are in conflict with each other because the local foods that we access often cost more than the others. And one of the mechanisms that we've used is a Good Food Box program. But we're also running into challenges there where, because the boxes have to be prepaid and picked up, again, they don't always work for very low-income people. And so I was really interested in the pocket markets happening in Victoria. We do something a little bit similar in seniors' high-rise buildings with low-income seniors. We have a traveling market that goes on a weekly basis with some local foods and then other foods from the wholesaler. And so we're wondering about increasing the number of markets that we're doing. But I also noticed on the website that the Victoria markets weren't operating this summer, and so I wondered kind of what issues they were running into there and if there were any lessons for us.
Well, I actually just was speaking with Leif Huge about this, about the reasoning for ceasing the market at this point in time. And I asked her, was there any, you know, one single reason that they had done this? And she said, well, actually, each of the markets is quite unique in terms of its location and its consumer base and what the strengths and weaknesses are. Part of the challenge is consumer culture, is how we are used to convenience, one-stop shopping. That's how we buy food now. And encouraging people, training people to come to the weekly market and buy food and plan, do their meal planning around the market is really a challenge, and that takes a long time. And sometimes the market viability and the solvency of food groups is threatened by the time lag of building up the interest and support for the market to the viability of the market.
Right.
Being able to sell enough volume.
Okay.
So, and the fact is that food, you know, they're having to, for their own survival, look at ways that are more economically viable for them, which are, they found this bulk. So bringing all their faithful customers to a bulk purchase on Saturdays is what they've found to be more viable. However, that takes away, and Lee's aware of this, the ability to get food into neighborhoods. So I don't think it's a strategy that they're abandoning. They do have a number of markets that have been quite successful.
Right.
But there needs to be a lot more shift, and it's happening slowly about people's, you know, buy-in to this.
Right. Okay, well, that's interesting to know, because in our case, in our case too, many of the customers, part the reason why we're interested in it is that they can't easily access the main distribution system. There are no stores accessible to them. So,
The other thing you talked about was accessibility, and I think that is a huge issue in terms of even the pocket markets trying to create a fair price for the local farmers. We're not talking about a lot more a cheaper food. We're talking about people understanding the value of their food.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a really interesting project, the Farmers Markets Coupon Project, that I'm really sad is being discontinued, and I'd like to see it continue in the future, and it may come back again. And that's where people were being able to take through receiving coupons through the Head Start Best Babies program here, and could redeem it at local markets.
Right.
And they were finding that they were getting the farmers at the markets were redeeming the coupons at double the value quite often.
Oh, wow.
And so they were finding as they did the projects over the years that they were getting more and more uptake by increase in fruits and vegetables into the diets of the people that were using the coupon program. So it's a really fabulous program. I'd like to see it come back again.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
I have another question. I don't mean to monopolize, but that raises an interesting question for me as well. We have just begun, well, we have for a couple of years, I guess, working with a First Nation that has an organic growers cooperative. And so now they have large quantities of organically grown potatoes and carrots that we are helping them to market in the city. And we do bulk buying for schools. Now, this produce is more expensive than what we could get through the wholesaler. And so I'm wondering if people have ideas or tips or resources out there about how to work with these cash-strapped school nutrition programs to help them see the value of paying extra for their carrots and potatoes.
I would suggest that they watch The Story of Stuff.
The Story of Stuff.
On YouTube.
Okay.
And it explains how costs are externalized in a very fun way.
Okay.
And you really get it.
Thank you for that tip.
And that there was a question posted on the chat that I saw a little while ago. I'm trying to scroll up here. About what do we need to do to increase consumer awareness? It came from Lauren, and she asked, how do we increase consumer awareness around the value of food, and can we share any success stories? I think it's really interesting that you bring up about the schools, because in terms of how we change our food culture, a lot of people look at the kids. You know, this is how we got recycling going, is the kids, and we brought that message home. And so there's lots of really great programs in the schools. I see them kind of sporadic and start up and fall apart just because of ongoing funding issues. But where kids get the opportunity to learn about food, the school fruit and vegetable program is a program that brings one on a weekly basis fruits and vegetables into the schools, but there's not a lot of education associated with that. But the school garden programs and the farm visits and the new salad bar programs, those are kinds of examples of programs where kids are getting more exposure to local food, and that, you know, opens the door to exploring all of these different issues. And I love that you brought up about the YouTube videos, because I think that is where we're also seeing a proliferation of information that's getting out there, that's in a format that people can digest and connect with and understand. I just saw a great one this morning of a woman who's setting up backyard farms in New York. She says there's 10,000 acres available in New York City. We're setting up a network of backyard farms, and to actually see her walking in the backyards, and it makes it real to people. And I think that's a real other tool that we have available to us that maybe some of us older folks, I hate to say that, I feel like I'm on that side, getting to be that side of the spectrum now, but can look at these new forms of social media to get the message out and do this shift in culture that we need to happen. Anything experiential, again, is another one that I want to point to that I've seen people take away. We're tasting, where they can taste and experience just what really good food tastes like, and hear the stories of how to cook it and prepare it at the same time. Like that, those I see as transformational in terms of consumer education as well.
Excellent. Excellent questions. So there's also another question posted here on the chat line from Scott from Waterloo. And it's probably a question for Alec. He's asking, do you think government policies need to address the increasingly consolidated distribution network of our large grocery retailers? Or are market-based grassroots approaches sufficient? Should private sector examples such as Tesco incorporation of local food be looked at as the future of local food, or will government policy be required?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we require is the first thing we require is there's two things I think we require. Number one is we require greater information about what's actually available locally and what volumes. I'll give you an example of why. The other day I was on a panel, Linda was on that panel too, and we had the representative of University of Victoria's purchasing department on the panel. And I sort of in private conversation I said to her, look, people here are telling you to buy local. You know, what are the issues for you? And she turned to me and she looked at me and she said, Alec, the main issue is, can the locals guarantee supply? Can they guarantee quality? And can they sort whatever they're sending to us and clean it and package it in such a way that it doesn't impact our labor costs? So there are all these really, really practical questions that we need to address. And the first, you know, the nub of the question is, what's available? How much of it's available, what the quality is available, what's the delivery mechanisms around that. And if once we have that kind of information available and we start to incentivize local businesses, perhaps through subsidy, and that's the way that government policy could get involved, to move food, local food, in these efficient ways to local purchasers, we can then, and that's happening in a certain way with farmers markets, we can set up local alternatives to, if you like, big business, national, international distribution systems that begin to compete with them and push them in more local directions as well. But I think that's one place we need to start. Does that help?
Great.
Alex, it's Ken Babich calling on the line. I unfortunately was unable to be there on Thursday. I had
right.
a commitment. But just so everybody knows, we've made a very concerted effort to support the farming community on Vancouver Island. And our last product tender, which is worth about $1 million, we actually indicated in the tender documents that, in fact, we wanted certain products to be sourced from Vancouver Island farmers. And there were 34 line items that actually were identified by Heritage Co-op that, in fact, would be sourced through the Vancouver Island farmers. It ended up we ended up with over 50 items that were actually supplied by Vancouver Island farmers. And 47% of the product that we that's part of that contract actually was produced and is being supplied to us through various distributors and cooperatives through our distributor for the university. That constitutes about 36% of the value of that contract. So we buy a lot of product that is sourced through a competitive process from producers on Vancouver Island. So and again, what Heather said to you is very true. We have logistics issues, we have quality issues, we in fact have some funding issues. There's only a certain amount of money that's made available for food. And so those are the challenges that we have as an institution. But in terms of supporting the farmers, well, it's all supply and demand. Can they supply the product when we need it, seasonal, et cetera? So there's a whole bunch of issues that we're tackling with the group now.
Very interesting.
This is Judy Stafford from Cowichan, Green, Sweeney, and Duncan with a few people here.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
I have two questions. One, I can't get on the chat room, and the link that I have, it doesn't work.
Okay, so I'll for everyone, the chat line is www.chatzy.com/CSE Hub. And so did you have a question for
yep.
the speakers?
I tried that. For some reason, I can't get on. Anyway, I just want to go back to Alex's comment about...
Right around here.
I appreciate about what the institutions
it's
are saying
the
about
just out there.
They
I
want guarantees on
in.
The supply. However, what we feel,
there
to go a little deeper on that, is we need to educate people on what is available. If people want everything all the time, then there's no way that here, locally, we can produce what people are supposedly demanding. So I think that if we start educating people a little bit more about not just having everything you want, whenever you want, because that it is now coming up to winter time and this is what's available. So we need to also educate our people that are purchasing that this is what's available here.
Yeah. Can I respond to that? It's Ken Babbage. When we went forward with that solicitation, which is almost 2 years now, we actually went to the Heritage Co-op and we said two things. First of all, we gave them a complete listing of the items that we typically would buy for the university. We also said to them, are there products that are not on this list that you can supply to us that we should be looking at? And so that's how we went about the process.
Excellent. So does that answer your question? That was a great suggestion. Go ahead.
I appreciate that actually, and I think it was a very good process, and it was definitely a starting point. And so I do appreciate what was going on. I just think that people need to realize that oranges are just not available here.
Yeah.
So.
And just another comment. I was at a College and Valley Food Fair here 3 weeks ago, and I did visit one of the farmers, Ardella or. Farm, and I asked him if he's supplying any of his product through the supply chain so that the university, in fact, is getting their product. And he says, no. He says, I can't supply the quantity you guys want or need. And so we are reaching out to the farmers to see if they can actually ramp up to produce more product.
Well, Ken, this is Alec again. That's why a key issue here, and this is what we're working on quite hard, is to try and develop a reasonably accurate inventory of what's available in different local regions. And, the issues, these are difficult research issues to actually see if you can use locally gathered statistics or government-gathered statistics to help purchasing managers and to help farmers understand, what potential local supply is there and how it might be accessed.
Yeah, right. Well, the reason I was not there on Thursday is I had to go to Port Hardy, and this was very disturbing for me in that I went up to Port Hardy, and I go along all these clear cuts, which is beautiful flat land that the forestry companies go and rake the trees off the property and leave the barren land there, and the land is flat, very, very rich in terms of soil, and it ends up just growing back into brush. Why isn't that turned over into farming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
I mean, most of the hard work has already been done. They've gone and they've taken the trees and made an economy, and then you get acres and acres and acres of flat land that is just abandoned. Why isn't that put into farming?
Well, that's an interesting question to investigate, further investigate. And we're about 10 a.m. now, and that wraps our session this morning. Really lively discussion and lots of energy on the call. Thanks a lot for everyone for participating. I also want to really thank our two speakers, Alec Ostrey and Linda Geggy, for joining us this morning, and thank all the participants as well. If you have any further resources, please go ahead and post them on the chat line. It'll be open all day as well. The session's been recorded and an MP3 will be available on the social economy. And having